On Briefing, I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side.
Hello, my name is Holly Hedgepeth, and I'm with the Cancer Services Program of Columbia and Greene County, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC ACRA.
Just remember, this is your radio station, and to keep it going smoothly, it helps if you become a sustaining supporter. What that means is you go to our website, you click on donate, and you make a monthly donation, which we will take it out of your credit card for you. Actually, I think it notifies you every month to make sure you still want to do it, and just kind of give whatever you can give monthly. $10 a month, $5 a month.
Right.
It's not hard. It's not hard.
No, it's a good idea.
If you care about this station.
It's a very good idea.
Become a friend of WGXC now by going to wgxc.org/donate.
Wave Farm programs are made possible, in part, by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of Governor Andrew Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program administered in Greene County by the Greene County Council on the Arts, the Alexander and Marjorie Hover Foundation, the Foundation for Contemporary Arts, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors.
All together now is a collaborative local news show. Anyone can learn how to be a reporter. Send a story idea to news@wgxc.org. Add an event to the WGXC.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
You've tuned in to All Together Now, WGXC's regional look at the news from Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, from the Catskills to the Berkshires and beyond. I'm Tom Rowe, and today you'll hear all sorts of local news updates, weather, interviews, and more, plus community events and the song of the day on All Together Now.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Accra, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews. Next, the national headlines from Public News Service.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Tuesday, August 7, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. Gates flips and testified he committed crimes with Paul Manafort. Also on the Monday rundown, reports from two states on primary election day. And kids in car deaths, some parents deny it can happen to them. Now our top story, testimony from the man who helped President Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, set up a group of shell companies. Those companies, the feds claim, were used to launder millions of dollars earned working for foreign leaders. The Daily News reports he testified Monday he hid the money for the IRS at the direction of his former boss. The testimony came from Rick Gates, Manafort's former protege and once the president's deputy campaign chair.
The news says the feds charged Manafort, with Gates' help, set up a dozen dummy companies in Cyprus, St. Vincent, the Grenadines, and the Seychelles Islands, and disguised payments to look like loans in order to avoid paying income tax. It is primary election day in some states. Suzanne Potter reports groups in Michigan on all sides of the political spectrum are urging all eligible voters to put in their 2 cents.
Michigan voters head to the polls today for a midterm election that will decide each party's candidate for governor, senator, member of Congress, state senator and representative, plus county and township races. Michigan has almost 7.4 million registered voters, but in the last primary in 2014, only 17.4% of them actually cast a ballot. Randy Block, director of the Michigan Unitarian Universalist Social Justice Network, says primaries are extremely important, especially now.
Sometimes with gerrymandering in particular, it's really important to vote in the primaries, because often those are the votes that determine who will ultimately be the winner in the general election.
Many groups are offering rides to the polls, including Southeast Michigan Jobs with Justice. You can find your polling place on the Secretary of State's website. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Michigan law requires voters to either show ID at the polls or sign a brief affidavit that they don't have one. Meantime, Mary Sherman reports a special election today in Ohio is drawing national attention, as some experts say it's a bellwether for President Trump.
Voters will choose between Republican Troy Balderson or Democrat Danny O'Connor for the 12th congressional district seat, left vacant by Republican Pat Tiberi. An assistant professor of political science at the University of Dayton, Christopher Devine, explains the Columbus area district has traditionally been Republican-held and was won by President Trump in 2016.
This is one where Republicans should win. If, however, a Democrat were to win the race instead, it would be seen as an indication that Democrats are particularly strong this year, that there is a backlash against President Trump, such that they might take at least the House in the November midterms.
Democrats need to win 23 seats in the November midterms to regain control of the House. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation.
Voters will be filling the interim seat today and will vote again in November to fill the seat for the next 2-year term. In Connecticut, low-income people who are HIV positive can now get their medication delivered to their door free of charge.
The Community Renewal Team, based in Hartford, has joined with a pharmacy to launch a new program that can help those who may have trouble getting to the drugstore to fill their prescriptions. According to CRT Vice President Heidi Lubetkin, the program will help those with incomes less than 300% of the federal poverty level maintain their health by sending prescription medications through the mail directly to those who need them.
By having a delivery service, the pharmaceuticals can get right to that person's home, apartment, or wherever they're dwelling. They don't have to figure out how they're going to get a bus pass, get onto transportation, go to the pharmacy, and those kinds of things.
The service is available to those who participate in CRT's Ryan White program and have either Medicare or private insurance. More information is available at www.crtct.org. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
And Texas Dreamers, young people brought to the U.S. when they were small children, bracing for the next legal hurdle facing the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, also known as DACA. And finally, Stephanie Carson tells us temperatures will drop to 90 degrees in much of Arkansas this week, and with that comes a concern of children being left in cars.
Last year, 43 children died of heat stroke after being left in a hot car, including an Arkansas child who was left in a daycare van. This month, Cars for Kids, a car donation nonprofit, released the results of a survey that found only 16% of parents surveyed think they might forget and leave their child in a hot car. Ari Finkelstein with the organization says incidences are higher in our region.
We believe it does happen more often in southern states. They think it happens to bad parents, to irresponsible, neglectful parents. They think that a lot of these parents are doing it intentionally, and they just don't think that such a thing could happen to themselves.
Forgotten baby syndrome describes the ability for a person to unintentionally leave a child confined in a car. And scientists say it's possible because our brains go on autopilot with routine activities such as driving to and from work. Numerous smartphone apps are available that create an alert for parents to check their back seat before exiting their car. Finkelstein says only 15% of parents take precautions, but adds that you don't have to invest in technology for an extra measure of protection.
The Centers for Disease Control says temperatures inside a car can rise almost 20 degrees Fahrenheit within the first 10 minutes, even with the window cracked open. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a 70% chance of showers or thunderstorms Tuesday, mainly after 2 p.m., the high near 84, the low around 68. Chance of rain continues into Wednesday, wherein there's a predicted high of 80 and a low around 65. Then Thursday, things should turn mostly sunny, with a high near 80 and a low around 63. Tom Rover, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported, Creative Community Radio.
Next, we have these reports.
I'm Tom Rowe with the WGXC News Update. You can go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about anything you hear here. Daniel Furfuro reports in the New York Post that the feud between Representative John Faso, the Republican from Kinderhook, and Governor Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat, continues. Now Faso is backing legislation that would give the federal government oversight with local infrastructure projects. Really, the Removing Extra Transportation Infrastructure Luxury Expenses Act is a jab at Cuomo, who spent $30 million extra on blue and gold tiles inside the Queens, Midtown, and Brooklyn Battery tunnels. Quote, I'm a strong supporter of spending money on infrastructure, but I'm not a supporter of wasting tax dollars, and that's what this was, unquote, Faso said, of the colored tile spending. Quote, Faso always puts partisan politics over representing New Yorkers, as his vote to raise taxes on his own constituents shows, unquote, said Cuomo spokesperson Rich Azzopardi. Quote, as far as color of tiles, he should walk into his bathroom and look around to see that they use different colors, and if he ever looked around in the old and new tunnel, he would have noticed that they both used two colors, unquote. Read the full story in the New York Post. Jesse J. Smith reports at Hudson Valley One that in July, Ulster County Executive Mike Hine signed a bill making the county the fourth community in New York to ban therapy that seeks to alter a youth's sexual orientation or gender identity. The so-called conversion therapy ban passed by a unanimous vote of the Ulster County Legislature on June 20th. The bill mandates 1 year in prison and fines of up to $500 for anyone who practices conversion or reparative techniques on anyone under the age of 18 in Ulster County. So far, 14 states, the District of Columbia, and 43 municipalities around the country have banned the practice. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo signed an executive order that stops practitioners from seeking reimbursement from insurance companies. Read the full story at Hudson Valley One. Audrey Matat reports in the Greenville Pioneer that the Town of Greenville Board voted unanimously to deny Cypress Creek Renewables a hardship from the town's six-month commercial solar moratorium that was adopted in April. Cypress Creek wants to put a 2-megawatt project at 9775 State Route 32 in Freehold. Cypress Creek also has current or recent projects in Coxsackie, Catskill, Caro, Greenville, Westerloo, Palinville, and other local towns. Many local towns have instituted solar moratoriums as companies rush to set up large-scale solar farms in the area. Read the full story in the Greenville Pioneer. I'm Tom Rowe, reporting for WGXC. Go to the newsroom at WGXC.org for more information and links to all these stories.
Tune in to All Together Now, WGXC's collaborative hour-long news show at 6 p.m., featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews. Tune in to learn more about the issues that affect communities throughout the Capital Region and the Hudson Valley, from the Catskills to the Berkshires.
Get this record for me, won't you please?
I should keep records of these things.
WGXC Record Fair 2018 is coming back Sunday, September 16th at the Basilica Hudson. Vendors from across the Northeast will gather at Basilica's main hall to sell vinyl, CDs, cassette tapes, DVDs, books, musical equipment and instruments, and radio-related ephemera. If you want to get involved and sell records, CDs, or more at WGXC's Record Fair, email recordfair@wgxc.org or call 518-697-7400. That's recordfair@wgxc.org.
Scholar and a Soros Justice Advocacy Fellow. She was the board chair of Drama Club, which conducts their theater workshops inside of juvenile facilities, and was on the board of the New York State Defenders Association and Reentry Columbia. Prior to working at the University of Essex, she was an assistant professor of sociology at the State University of New York at New Paltz and a research scholar in law at Yale Law School. She was also part of the Prison Voices Project Radio Collective, which produced a regular show on WGXC in Hudson and taught a college course at Brookwood Secure Center. She is the author of Trapped in a Vice, The Consequences of Confinement for Young People, and we'll be selling that at the back if you're interested in that book, and she will be signing it for you. After she speaks, she will be joined in conversation with Frankie Y. Bailey, PhD she's a professor in the School of Criminal Justice, University of Albany, SUNY. She studies crime history and crime in mass media, popular culture, and material culture. She is the author of 5 mysteries featuring amateur sleuth Lizzie Stewart and 2 police procedural novels featuring Albany police detective Hannah Stewart. Frankie collaborates with the Prison Public Memory Project on scholarship about the birth and evolution of the House of Refuge for Women and the New York State Training School for Girls in Hudson, New York. Frankie is a professor in the School of Criminal Justice at the University of Albany. She serves as the director of the school's Justice and Multiculturalism in the 21st Century Project. So we're very proud to have both ladies with us, and we'll begin with Alexandra.
So thank you so much, Brenda, for organizing this event, and also to Emily. I'm really grateful to be here, and also to the Prison Public Memory Project, which has been so helpful to me. And about 10 years ago, I really first started doing research here, but this project really started a lot earlier than that. Back in 2004, I started working in New York City, and I was representing teenagers charged as adults under a law called the Juvenile Offender Statute. And that statute was passed in 1978, and it allowed for 13 to 15-year-olds to be charged as adults and to face adult-level penalties in New York. And many of those young people were my clients. They were young people in New York City who were facing really lengthy penalties. And so many of those young people were being sent to Brookwood, which is right outside of Hudson. And it was funny because I spent so much time with my clients on Rikers Island or in many of the juvenile facilities in New York City, but I really never spent any time in the places where I was really so strongly advocating for them, in many ways, not to go, but where they ended up. And I left that job to go to graduate school, and I really became interested in how little had been written about young people's time inside of juvenile facilities, and sort of so few people who had gone inside and studied the texture of what happens inside of facilities. And Brookwood was what brought me back to New York. And in many ways, Willie Boskett, who was the young man who at the beginning of, really set, in 1978, set off the and initiated the kind of laws that were passed, which allowed so many of my clients to be sentenced to such lengthy terms of custody, was in many ways the reason why I came here. In 1978 was the year of my birth, and it was the year when Willie was 15 years old and was accused of killing 2 people on the New York City subways. And under the laws at the time, Willie would have only faced up to 5 years in a juvenile facility in the state of New York, and there was a public outcry about his case. And the New York State Legislature subsequently passed laws which would really begin to shape the lives of so many young people in New York. So what I want to think about today is sort of how this person, this Willie Boskett, kind of, and his story, and in fact he passed through Brookwood Secure Center in 1974, began to kind of shape actually some of the stories which I'll talk about today, which are the ways that in some ways what we assume to be true about youth punishment, which is that it's ever increasingly more soft or more therapeutic, actually has some sort of somewhat darker undertones, which I think are important to kind of understand. So what I'll talk about today are kind of four key claims. One is that I want to talk about why the Hudson Valley, and Hudson in particular, is a really important lens through which we can kind of understand juvenile justice and the history of juvenile imprisonment in New York State more broadly. Also, the fact that juvenile justice landscapes cannot be neatly characterized as either punitive or treatment focused, and that in many ways the history of juvenile justice teaches us that there's a complex relationship between care and control. That the interventions used with young people in facilities, in custody, have to be understood in terms of the broader context of in which they are being sentenced, and the kind of criminalization processes that that are used and approaches used with them. And then also, juvenile facilities themselves are often highly misunderstood, that so much of us know about these places or think about these places through, today it's Netflix or documentaries or public scrutiny, but we know so little about what happens inside. And these places are very complex, and for the many people who work inside of them, I think the facilities themselves are really often misunderstood, and I want to try to give a little bit more texture to what goes on inside of them. So thinking about Hudson Valley, Brookwood Secure Center is really a place that's located, as for those of you who are sort of unfamiliar with it, right outside of Hudson and Claverack. And it was originally a site served as an annex for the Hudson Training School for Girls, and was a facility for girls who were said to require more intense levels of treatment. And it's a facility now which houses young men charged as juvenile offenders, but also now girls again, because a few years ago girls were brought back to Brookwood, and girls charged as juvenile offenders themselves. And it's a place which brought me here, but also I think has become a really important place for me to think about the history of care and control. In the middle of the 19th century, Charles Loring Brace, who was a New York philanthropist and social reformer, he became concerned about the rising numbers of poor European immigrant children in New York City. He was disconcerted by city-based institutions aimed at the care of young people. Instead, he saw promise and potential in rural facility life. He felt that the outcasts, vicious, reckless multitudes of New York's boys swarming in every foul alley and low street could only be reformed in the homes of good rural families. So you'll see the child savers kind of recovering the young children from New York City streets and bringing them to the pastures, the rural pastures, where they could be cured and reformed. And Charles Loring Brace founded the kind of the orphan train movement, which was a movement to bring young children out to the kind of rural heartland. But it was Charles Loring Brace's philosophy of care about rural life that interested me at first, in part because when I first began doing this work, of course, so many of the facilities where young people are sent are in rural areas across New York State, and yet so many of the children that I had been initially serving were from New York City. And at the time that I began my work, really it was 60% of young people in care who were sent from New York City to these rural facilities. I became really intrigued by the kind of guiding philosophy of sentimental pastoralism, which was really this idea that the removal and care of children in rural life would have restorative properties in their kind of beings and their characters. But I also began to think about the ways that it was important to be critical about this history and to interrogate it, because it was built on the assumption that a child's home environment and also their family set their criminality into motion. And it was oriented around the idea that that criminality could be cured or restored through rural life. But it never allowed us, in many ways, to turn the lens away from the lawbreakers, from the children, towards the lawmakers themselves. In what ways did or do those lawmakers kind of contribute also to that process of criminalization that led those children away from places like New York City? Who was criminalized? In many ways, that question has been increasingly important, as we know that the early facilities were built only for white children, and the children who were deemed to be reformable were only white children. And as we shift, and I'll talk a little bit more about what the facilities look like today, how do we think about that question differently? So as the juvenile reform movement set into motion, what really a lot of the reformers began to think about was that young people, the sense was that young people should not be housed in facilities with adults. They should be separated from adults and could only be reformed in facilities separate from adults, which in part led to the establishment of the reformatory and training school movement. So with the beautiful work of Prison Public Memory Project, we've really unearthed so much information about the Hudson Girls Training School.
Hello, this is WGXC 90.7 FM Accra. Do you read me?
WGXC believes in creative use of the airwaves. WGXC is a program division of the nonprofit arts organization Wavefarm, based in Accra, New York. We are the only station in the country to dedicate significant airtime to radio as an artistic medium. Tune into transmission art and experimental sound programming overnight and all day on Saturdays, and hear artists from all over the world who sculpt and compose with the airwaves.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the Healthcare Consortium, a rural health network dedicated to improving access to healthcare and supporting the health and well-being of the people in our rural community. Throughout 2018, the Healthcare Consortium will be celebrating 20 years of serving the residents of Columbia and Greene counties. To learn more about the Healthcare Consortium and its services, please visit www.columbiahealthnet.org or call 518-822-8820.
In the next segment, my co-host sat down with Citizen Action's Karen Scharf to talk about the upcoming primary election taking place in September, the importance of November's general election here in New York, and the work Citizen Action is doing.
Can you tell me a little bit about Citizen Action and the role that you play with the organization?
Sure. Citizen Action of New York is a statewide grassroots organization. We've got 8 chapters and affiliates in 8 regions across the state, from Buffalo across upstate, down the Hudson Valley, and then New York City and Long Island. And in all of our chapters and statewide, we work for economic, racial, social, and environmental justice, taking on critical issues facing our local communities, our state, and our country to try to make New York and the country and each of our regions a better place for ordinary New Yorkers to live and a place that's more where we can experience more democracy and more justice. And in all of those areas, we do our work by organizing ordinary New Yorkers to get active and get involved and have much more of a say in what happens in their community and in their state and country.
Citizen Action is a little bit different from some other nonprofits that work on progressive issues in that you actually do get involved in electoral campaigns. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We definitely believe that we can't make the kind of transformational changes we want without having better people in office, people who are better representative of the needs of ordinary New Yorkers, low-income New Yorkers, working families, New Yorkers across the state in all kinds of communities, so that we have people in office who are not only representative, but who are willing to take on the most challenging issues of the day and try to really make a difference. And we also think it's really important that if someone's in office and is not doing a good job for their community, that there's accountability, that people are willing to run against them and vote them out of office. So we very much encourage challengers where we have incumbents who are not doing a good job for their district. And then we also support incumbents where we have somebody who's doing a really great job. And we found, one of our leaders used to always say, you can't do politics 364 days a year and not do it the one day that the politics politicians care about, because the bottom line is people who are in office want to get reelected, and the only way you really get accountability is if you're willing to either help them get reelected or take them on and make sure they get kicked out of office if they're not doing the job.
What does that work look like on the ground?
We involve our members and also just grassroots activists in each of the regions in working on behalf of candidates that we endorse. We have a very in-depth endorsement process where we have candidates fill out a questionnaire that goes through all of the different issue areas that we care about, and also really look to see what are the candidates' core values and how are they looking at the world overall and what does it mean to them to fight for justice. Then we do, our members do interviews and then make recommendations to our statewide board of directors, which makes the ultimate decisions on our state-level endorsements, or the local boards, which make decisions on local endorsements. And once we've endorsed, then we involve our folks in doing phone banks, going door to door, all of the things that people see that are on the grassroots side of campaigning. People are seeing, you know, every day now, volunteers from Citizen Action coming to their door on behalf of our candidates, whether it's Cynthia Nixon and Jamani Williams for governor and lieutenant governor, or some of our candidates for state senate. They're hearing from our members about why we're supporting those candidates and talking to them about why they should vote for them.
The election that's coming up in November, it's important. It's not just important on the national level at the top of the ticket for president, but also the control of our state senate here in New York is at play. What are some of the issues that are at stake depending on who controls the state senate?
You're right. It's a really critical election because, as you know, our state senate has been controlled by the Republicans, sometimes straight out, sometimes with the support and votes of the Independent Democratic Conference, which is a group of Democrats that chose to prop up Republican control instead of having Democratic control of the Senate. And people might hear this as kind of just an insider political thing, but the thing is that which party controls the state senate turns out to have an incredible impact on what policies are passed in New York State, which has an incredible impact on people's everyday lives. So, for example, in 2019, the issue of rent control in New York City will be coming back to the legislature, because New York has this crazy system where New York City doesn't get to make its own rules. The state gets to make the rules for New York City and for the other localities around the state. So the state legislature will decide whether or not tenants in New York City have any shot at having affordable housing, or whether it's going to continue to get more and more expensive and people are going to continue to get pushed out of their homes and out of their neighborhoods because of unaffordable housing. So New York City folks will come to the legislature next year in 2019, and tenants will be there to say, I can't afford my rent. You got to keep it from going up any higher. You need to preserve rent control and put in more controls. The landlords will be there saying, no, we need freedom to charge whatever we want, because, you know, that's capitalism and we get to make money off our property and we get to drive people out of their homes if we want to. And that will be a huge fight. And what we're seeing is those real estate interests who want nothing more than to charge more rent so that they can make more money and more money in their pockets are funding state Senate campaigns outside of New York City, where these senators have no, they don't have any constituents who are going to be affected by this, but those senators are being funded, the Republicans and the independent Democrats are being funded by the big real estate interests from New York City in order to make sure that they have a Senate that will preserve the control of real estate and be unresponsive to the needs of ordinary tenants in New York City and around the whole rest of the state, because tenants around the whole state, while we may not have rent control, we have lots of problems with lack of affordable housing. People literally cannot afford their rent in every part of New York State. So we'll have a huge fight in 2019 over housing justice, specifically rent control, but also tenant protections, evictions, all the kinds of things that affect tenants statewide. And if we have a Democratic-controlled Senate, especially one that has fewer, if we have a Senate that's accountable to voters and tenants, we will have strong housing justice laws passed. If we have a Senate that's still controlled by the Senate Republicans, we will have bad housing laws passed, and people will find that their rent is even more unaffordable. And that's like one of the most blatant examples, because real estate is such a huge force in New York State politics and spends their money to get senators in office who will do exactly what they want, and they've succeeded. That's why we have unaffordable housing. That's why people can't afford the rent, because real estate has succeeded in electing people to the state Senate. So they succeeded in electing people who will protect their interest in making money rather than the interest of ordinary New Yorkers in having a place they can afford to live and make their rent off of a normal salary. So that's going to be one issue that's very much at stake and very clearly going to come to the fore, because rent control laws expire next year and have to either get extended, improved, or weakened. We'll also see a big fight again over funding for our schools. This is an issue Citizen Action has worked on for decades now, where New York has one of the most inequitable funding systems for our public schools, where the rich school districts spend far more than the poor school districts. One of our biggest victories was in 2007, when we were able to work with Governor Spitzer and enact a new foundation aid formula that was based on equitable funding. Fortunately, Governor Cuomo has chosen not to implement that funding formula. So we still have unfair funding. We still have $4.2 billion. That's $4.2 billion owed to our public schools across the state, most of it owed to schools in Black and brown communities where there's just not the property tax base to pay for schools, and we really depend on the state for that funding.
So that's what you mean by equitable funding, is that some school districts are getting a tremendous amount of resources and other school districts in areas that don't have the tax base just don't have the money for textbooks, for facilities, for extracurricular activities. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly right. So New York State has our school systems funded by a combination of property taxes and state funds. And those districts that have a wealthy property tax base have a lot of money. And those districts that don't are entirely dependent or almost entirely dependent on the state to make up for what they don't have in a property tax base. And the state does do that, but doesn't do it anywhere near adequately. So it still leaves our public schools in the poorer communities, both rural and urban, significantly underfunded, and then they don't have the new textbooks, they don't have enough teachers, they don't have the kind of course offerings that a place like, you know, Scarsdale or Jericho or would have. So that's the kind we've been, you know, if we have a state senate that's willing to really dig in and fight for equitable funding, we have a shot at getting it. If we have a state senate that remains as is, will it continue to have inequitable funding in New York State? And again, that does also tie back, just like the housing fight ties back to campaigns, so does the education fight, because not only does it matter who's in there, but also many of the Republicans and independent, so-called independent Democrats, are funded by the big Wall Street and hedge fund donors who don't want to see New York raise taxes on the rich to pay for its schools.
Another thing that we're seeing with this election is more women and more people of color running for office across the country. What are you seeing on the ground here in New York?
Yeah, I'm seeing a huge amount of excitement over that exact fact. People are really excited to see more women and people of color running, and they're especially excited to see people running who come out of our communities and who really are running to be in either in Albany or Washington in order to represent the needs of average, ordinary New Yorkers, not the kind of special interests we've been talking about. And I'm seeing a couple things in relation to that. Definitely seeing the excitement, and definitely seeing a lot of energized volunteers who want to see people elected. And seeing also seeing for the first time in a serious way these candidates, both women and people of color, being able to raise grassroots money, because one of the big barriers to women and people of color for running is the fact that our campaign finance system is so expensive. And if you don't have money or have access to money, it's hard to be able to afford a campaign. And that's one of the other big things we want to change next year. If we have a Democratic Senate, we hope to create pass a serious democracy agenda that improves voting rights and the campaign finance system so that everybody can raise money through small donations and public matching funds and be able to run. And that would make a huge difference for the candidates we're supporting this year if they had those public matching funds and didn't have to rely on trying to find rich donors in addition to their small donors. But we are seeing a lot of small donor response, a lot more money being raised from small donors, enabling people who are not wealthy to run and to be able to fund their campaigns. And we're also seeing incredible excitement among both the volunteers and the candidates about the kind of issues I'm talking about, fighting for housing justice, fighting for economic justice, fighting for a democracy agenda, including campaign finance reform, and fighting for our schools. And also, the one other issue I hadn't mentioned that we're seeing a lot become very active in the campaigns is the issue of mass incarceration, ending mass incarceration, and the link of that to all the other issues that we're talking about. We've talked a lot about the need to invest in schools, not jails, and that's something that we're hearing a lot of candidates and a lot of grassroots volunteers really committed to. We're also seeing some backlash, honestly. The people in power don't want to see new people running for office, don't want to see people that are not controlled by special interests, don't want to see people that are really going to represent ordinary New Yorkers get elected. And we're definitely seeing candidates, establishment candidates, using, in usually subtle but sometimes not so subtle ways, sexism and racism to turn voters against some of these new candidates who are running, who are women and people of color. We saw it in my congressional district right now, where John Faso, my congressman, who has, you know, over and over again voted in favor of the wealthy specialists, just not the constituents in his district, not me and my neighbors, by taking away our health care and other things that he's done that have been really detrimental to the average working person in the district. He's trying to hide that by going after his opponent by using coded language around race. Antonio Delgado, who's a Democratic candidate who we support, who's fantastic, and who is spoken to every one of the issues we're talking about and spoken about how he's going to bring change to Congress. Instead of taking on those issues, having a real debate, talking about what he stands for, John Faso has tried to turn voters against Antonio by saying he's not one of us. And that language is that typical coded racism, trying to say to white voters in the district, he's not white, so don't vote for him. And that's the you know, incredible reactionary politics that we're seeing in reaction to some of these amazing new candidates. We're even seeing it in the lieutenant governor's race, where we have Sermonti Williams, who we're supporting for lieutenant governor, African-American, strong activist on issues of housing and ending mass incarceration. And again, the lieutenant governor right now, instead of taking him on those issues and talking about the things that he's talking about or trying to defend her own bad record of having a very high rating, from 100% rating from the NRA when she was in Congress, and when she was a county clerk, she was the person who killed the drive, one of the leaders of the effort to kill driver's license for immigrants. Instead of speaking to her bad record and the things that Jemani has fought for, she's attacking Jemani for being a struggling working class person, just like so many New Yorkers, is running ads, attacking her opponent because he started a small business, and like so many small businesses, it didn't make it, and he still owes money on that. She's going after him for that. That, you know, that's what happens to people in New York and in America right now, because the economy is so rigged against so many of us. When people start a small business, it's tough. Some people make it, and that's great. A lot of people struggle, don't make it. We're glad they tried, but the fact that they didn't succeed doesn't mean they shouldn't run for office and represent us in Albany and be able to try to fix the very problems that they face. And Jemani is a man who understands what it's like to struggle, what it means to not have the money to get your small business off the ground, what it means to struggle to have to pay your bills because you're, you know, living on a working person's salary. Unfortunately, our lieutenant governor doesn't understand that and is using a very elitist and, I think, underlying racist argument to attack him.
It's time for the Hudson Valley Song of the Day, a performance from a musician visiting the Capital Region or Hudson Valley, or who regularly plays around these parts.
Columbia County's Rasputina perform at the Colony Cafe in Woodstock on August 9th. Here's Columbia County's Rasputina with Snow Hen of Austerlitz from their Sister Kinderhook album.
Say not far away, in fact upon that hill, they say that there's a little girl there still. She wasn't raised like the other kids. Lost them a snow hen, lost her lids. The mother is blind and keeps some birds as pets. That her baby is a human she forgets, and a tiny wire pen that little girl still sits. Miss them the snow hen of Austerlitz. She must be 10 or 11 now, and she's pretty but she don't have all her wits. She is the snow hen of Austerlitz. Not having really neither wings nor beak, she never learned to walk or speak. Child, the mother never says a word to communicate. This little girl, she chirps like a bird. All the birds around, they taught the little girl their language. When she's not understood, she starts to get real angry. So she waves her hands around just like they were her wings. Oh, but when she's happy, you should hear her sing. She's known as the snow hen of Austerlitz. Kept like a pet in an old hen coop.
You're listening to the WGXC News Update. I'm Alana Medlock. Audrey Matat is reporting for the Greenville Pioneer. Greenville town officials have denied the hardship application submitted by Cypress Creek Renewables for the company's proposed 2-megawatt solar project to be located on State Route 32 in Freehold. Cypress Creek submitted the application in May following the town's adoption of a 6-month commercial solar moratorium. Under the moratorium, if a property owner is able to prove an extreme financial hardship as a result of the ban, the town has the power to grant an exception. In its unanimous decision, the Greenville Town Board rejected Cypress Creek's request, finding the company did not carry the burden of proof that an extreme hardship did indeed exist. According to the board's resolution, the funds expended by Cypress Creek for the proposal were only potentially lost at this point and not necessarily as a result of the moratorium. That such costs of doing business are expected in any development process, whether formally approved or not. And the board found that the Central Hudson interconnection fees paid by Cypress Creek were not a substantiated loss as a result of the moratorium. Rather, the funds are contingent on whether the project is ultimately approved or not, and there has been so far no guarantee the proposed site plan would be approved. The board also stated the potential payment in lieu of taxes agreement remains under review and has not been finalized. Quote, indeed, it is possible that no such agreement will be reached, thereby effectively ending the project, end quote, the resolution stated. You can read the full story in the Greenville Pioneer. MidHudsonNews.com is reporting traffic is up on the 5 bridges over the Hudson River operated by the New York State Bridge Authority this year, compared to the first 6 months of 2017. The total revenue also increased in the first half of 2018. The greatest increase in traffic was reported on the Newburgh Beacon Bridge, with a 1.79% increase. Kingston-Rhinecliff Bridge traffic rose by 1.06%, while traffic on the Rip Van Winkle Bridge increased by 1.02%. The greatest increase in revenue during the first 6 months was on the Kingston-Rhinecliff Bridge at 1.49%, followed by the Mid-Hudson Bridge with a 1.08% increase. In total, agency revenue increased by 0.83% to $28 million from January through June of this year. Total crossings increased by 1.15% to nearly 31 million during the same time. Read the full story at MidHudsonNews.com. Brendan J. Lyons is reporting for the Times Union. The state Senate's plans to convene hearings soon to look at Governor Andrew Cuomo's use of criminal pardons and what majority Republicans allege is a trend of violent offenders being released from prison by the state parole board. Senate staffers said they found instances in which dozens of sex offenders who underwent reviews by the governor's office were issued conditional pardons. Some of those, they said, were cleared by the governor's office to receive the pardons, but then arrested for new crimes. The cases that have been highlighted by Senate Republicans include Cuomo's decision to grant a conditional pardon to Herman Bell, who was released from prison despite being sentenced to up to life in prison for murdering two police officers in 1971.
Richard Azzopardi, a spokesman for Cuomo, said other states grant voting rights to people on parole. In New York, he noted, the legislature has declined to deal with the issue or the inequity of New York laws that allow people on probation to vote, but not those on parole. Quote, this is not a radical proposal. This is just something that the legislature specifically refused to deal with, and we did it using our existing powers, end quote, Azzopardi said. The hearings will be overseen by Senator Patrick M. Gallivan, Republican of Elma, chair of the Senate Crime Victims, Crime and Correction Committee. Gallivan is a former member of the state parole board. The hearings have not yet been scheduled. You can read the full story in the Times Union. I'm Alana Medlock, and this has been the WGXC News Update.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a 70% chance of showers or thunderstorms Tuesday, mainly after 2 p.m., the high near 84, and low around 68. Chance of rain continues into Wednesday, wherein there's a predicted high of 80 and a low around 65. Then Thursday, things should turn mostly sunny, with a high near 80 and a low around 63. Time over WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported, creative community radio.
Coming up on the WGXC 90.7 FM community program schedule for Tuesday, August 7th, Pete Levensee starts the day in Catskill with the WGXC morning show from 9 to 11 a.m. He'll be talking with multimedia artist Matt Bua about the public art project commemorating 200 years since the publication of Washington Irving's tale, Rip Van Winkle. And Liz Kirkus, membership director and events coordinator of the Greene County Chamber of Commerce, will be joining in the second hour to talk about upcoming activities. At 2 on Purple House, hosted by Robert Tomlinson, a preview of the concert Songs of Innocence performed at Hilo on Wednesday, August 8th. Performing live in the studio will be Scott Petito and members of Seminole 60s band The Fugs, along with Catskill's own Brian DeWan and Ross Goldstein. James White from the Music Maestro Hour, Reverend Kim L. Singletary from There's a Bright Side Somewhere, and Alan Scarrett from Crossroads and Rhythm will all be guest hosts on the WGXC afternoon show from 4 to 6 p.m. live in the Carnegie Room of the Catskill Library. And later in the evening after the news hour at 7 o'clock, Leprous Garden, hosted by Mantis, followed by Battlefield Earth with Dan Seward from 9:30 to midnight.
After the Battlefield Earth show, tune in to Transmission Art overnight in the early morning hours of Wednesday, August 8th, Radio Stew at midnight, and then the Vital Weekly show with experimental music from Amsterdam at 1 a.m. The Foxy podcast is at 2 a.m. with more experimental sounds overnight on Wavefarm Standing Wave Radio and WGXC. There are so many events on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org, and you can add your own by pressing the Add an Event button right there on the page. If you do, folks like me will read your community event on the radio. Folks around the world will see it online at WGXC.org, including some of these events.
You can learn how to befriend your sewing machine Tuesday, August 7th at Drop Forge and Tool in Hudson. It's a workshop from 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Catskill has a town board meeting Tuesday, August 7th, 6:30 p.m. There should be a live webcast on the WGXC.org webpage. Click on Listen Now, and it may be on the radio too during All Together Now. Basilica Hudson's Back Gallery hosts the Social Justice Leadership Academy show 6 to 9 p.m. Wednesday, August 8th, with Hudson youth ages 12 to 20 showing their works. Thursday, August 9th, the Oakdale Lake Picnic is happening from 4 to 6 p.m., hosted by Friends of Hudson Youth and Friends of Oakdale Lake. There'll be food from the Oakdale Campers, Hawthorne Valley Sauerkraut, and more. Thursday, August 9th. Also, Thursday, August 9th, God.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
This is Echo. You are listening to WJFC Agra, Creative Community Magical Radio.
I'm a roadrunner, honey.
Thank you.